company. Yes, wherever I go, I'm a hobo CEO. I'm a hobo CEO.
Business, lifestyle, and the philosophical implications of business whilst wearing shabby trousers. Or no trousers at all. So, ladies, gentlemen, and hobos, welcome to another Hobo CEO podcast. I'm Chris Kirkland, and joining me today is Nico. How are you doing, Nico, sir?
I'm over here, Chris. I'm doing fine. You're coming live from the Play Cafe. I can hear in the background.
You can hear the smoothies being made in the background.
Delicious.
And where in God's name are you, sir?
I relocated on Monday to Da Nang, Vietnam. So after a couple of days in Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, where I retraced all our steps from last year, we now moved to Da Nang, which is really nice so far. I'm going to maybe share a little bit about it later.
Marvelous. In fact, this week we'll be talking about being a tourist versus a flaneur, which we shall interleave with our travel experiences and business experience.
Yes.
Marvelous. Thanks for a few people who've reached out to us recently and told us how amazing this podcast is.
Which is really nice. And how would we know about any of the social media things since we're not following...
Since we don't fucking look at
it. We're not following social media at the moment.
Actually, we do get notifications.
We do get some. But we'll talk a little bit about social media maybe later as well.
All right, before we get into flaneuring, let's hear from a fellow hobo about their suitcase.
Deeply overjoyed to be joined by Mr. Reineck today.
It's been a long time, Chris.
It has been too long, John. It has been too long. Sat here sweating in Saigon with my old buddy, Ho Chi Minh pal, John Reineck. So, sir, let us begin the hobo suitcase interview. What, in a sentence, is funding your hobo existence?
Seems like right now four businesses.
So four sentences.
Ugh. I have a fitness SaaS product for fitness businesses. I have a marketing product for other businesses. And I'm working on a top secret service business as well. Service as a service.
That's
four.
1, 2, 3.
There are two products in the fitness business.
Ah, splendid.
Sneaky. So
a multiple serial, no, parallel entrepreneur. You're a parallel entrepreneur.
I'd like to think that. Yes.
Splendid. And, well, where are you located at the moment?
In the moment, I am in Ho Chi Minh City, Saigon, Vietnam.
And let's open that question up a little bit more. Is this your base?
This is my home base, and we're using it to just sort of reach out and try other places through Asia. So we're definitely open to jumping around. We have been jumping around. We're looking. I say we. I'm with my girlfriend.
Yes. Hobo business couple.
Yes. She's also a hobo from New York City.
A hobo of the highest regard.
Thank you for saying that. I appreciate that.
As you are as well. Splendid. Well, let's get on to your luggage. First question is, what is the average weight of your luggage?
7K, straight up.
Wow, that is AirAsia
compliant. Exactly, yes.
That is super minimalist.
By design. I went with my mom and we picked out the lightest. We brought a little weight scale and measured the lightest one we could find. And that was my Christmas present last Christmas because I needed to fly Singapore Air under 7K carry-on only.
Have you ever had your luggage weighed?
Yes, all the time.
Actually at the airport?
Yeah, all the time. Yeah, they always do.
Which airports?
Definitely Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
I can remember that. Singapore, New York, Japan,
and are you checking
Tokyo,
in
Haneda.
Online?
Sorry.
Are you checking in online, having your board pass before you get to the airport?
I am, but because of visa requirements, I always have to show up at that gate.
Right.
I can't get away from that gate.
This is a important thing to know because I often skip the any kind of queue. And actually, this is now my interview, not your interview. When I went to Vietnam just now from Thailand. I didn't go to the AirAsia document check place. I just went straight to the gate because it was a Chiang Mai to Bangkok flight. I didn't think that they'd need to do anything. But just before boarding, they said, is Chris Kirkland here?
Uh-oh.
So I went up and they had to rush me back out and through immigration and all this kind of stuff. But they didn't weigh my luggage. There was no time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think because I generally have been flying Singapore, that's my airline of choice these days.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're really uptight about it. And Brooke has even told me stories about them coming through the seating area right before you get on the plane with a scale and weighing people's luggage.
Wow.
Yeah. She didn't get busted, but... Yeah, so even if you get past the first weigh station, mm-hmm. there's still a second weigh station potentially down the path. No problem, man. I'm under 7K.
You're under 7. You can sleep at night.
Exactly.
Splendid. All right, next question, which I think you've answered already. Cabin luggage only.
Absolutely. Always.
What about Brooke?
I can't do it. So this is a little bit of a tough situation. The fact of the matter is the girl likes to buy textiles. And she also knows that my suitcase is sitting there half full. And she's constantly salivating over that space. So there have been times, I must admit, where purchases have been made and I was forced to check.
Indeed. Relationships are about happy compromises.
That's right. That's right.
So what's most likely to get you questioned by airport security?
So... Every time I hear you ask this question, I answer this, that's not pro, dude. That's just not pro. You don't get pulled over. That's just, you know, you're not a professional traveler if you're getting pulled over. So my suitcase is by design created to not get pulled over no matter what. I would never risk it because that's, you know, you could get caught up for time. So anyways, nothing gets me pulled over. The only time I've ever been pulled over in my life was when I had a microphone just like the one you have there. But I do not travel with that now. Now I use headphones instead, so.
Man, you've got this down to a T.
Yes.
Low trouble traveling. All right, next question. Most expensive and least expensive thing worth carrying?
Okay, I want to highlight something that was really expensive. It's called the Roost Stand, and it was like a Kickstarter. Now you can just get it on their website, and mm-hmm. I use it to elevate my laptop on my desk. So I turn my laptop into a monitor with an additional external keyboard.
Uh-huh.
So I keep my neck straight.
Uh-huh.
And that is a very light thing, but it was very expensive. But I'm happy that I bought it. I like it very much.
How much was it?
I want to say $80.
Yeah.
That's a little crazy.
That's quite a lot for a stand.
Yeah, but I dig it.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. But then, I mean, going through the rest of my suitcase, I have 2 shirts, 2 pairs of pants. That's all I got. I don't have anything in there. I don't have anything else. So I figure I can splurge on my work station.
Splendid. And the least expensive?
Least expensive. My hot tip for the travelers out there. Never get caught without a Steripod. It's a little clip plastic thing that you put over your toothbrush. So you don't have to buy travel toothbrushes. You just buy a normal toothbrush everywhere you go. And then you clip this thing on and it can't get any dirt on it. And it also has a little, some sort of chemical that sucks the badness out of your toothbrush.
And that's called a Steripod?
Yeah, a Steripod. Steripod. And I think it costs 50 cents.
And have you seen them for sale outside the US?
I get them from Amazon.
Because
I've never seen them in a store before.
Yeah.
But they're pretty cool.
That's probably in need of an affiliate link from our listing here. Buy a Steripod for 50 cents.
I'd love 4% off of that.
Yeah, is it? 0.35 of a cent or whatever that'll earn us.
It's a perfect Amazon stocking stuffer to get you over the free shipping limit.
Final question. Anything else we might like to know about your luggage?
I feel like I really went to town and gave you everything you need to know here. I'm struggling. I travel with a portable mouse, a portable keyboard. This is it. Portable music station, a little super lightweight little box. It looks like the Bose thing, but it's not Bose.
Uh-huh.
It's like 1/10 the price of a Bose. And have awesome music everywhere I go.
So it's like a speaker?
Yeah, a little speaker. One of those little pod things that goes over Bluetooth.
What's the brand?
I couldn't tell you. It's bad.
It's bad.
It's a bad brand. It's a crappy, something a hobo might be able to afford.
Okay, well, we'll quiz you later and see if we can get it in the show notes. Splendid.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, John.
I'm so honored.
As am I to have the mighty Rhinek, owner of 4 businesses and 7-kilogram luggage. It's a winning hobo suitcase.
Winning combo.
Yeah. Splendid. Till the next time.
Yes, yes. Anytime.
Cool. Thank you, John. Splendid.
So, Nico, you're the intellectual on this podcast. What does flaneur mean? It's a long word for me.
I think it means something in English, something like strolling around without a specific destination. That's the right word.
It's so, like being spontaneous, isn't it?
Yes. So the concept we're talking about, and we have mentioned this and already, comes from, again, the anti-fragile book, Nassim Taleb's. And the distinction between the tourist and the flaneur is that, and this is in the specific context of traveling, that the tourist has scheduled everything in advance and he's kind of very bound to his schedule. He may even experience a lot of stress because he has to be at certain places at certain times and so on and so forth. Whereas the flaneur can just be way more opportunistic. He doesn't have anything planned. He can just stay if he likes where he's currently at and so on and so forth.
I like the sound of flaneur. Yeah. I think it's just more hip.
It is.
I mean, it's, for fuck's sake, it's a French sounding word. Who wants to be a tourist? I'm not a tourist. I'm not one of those bloody tourists. I'm a flaneur.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go. I think there's 1 point for flaneur straight away, just because it's called flaneur.
Yeah.
So let's just start with the travel scenario and maybe have a look at a little bit why it works and doesn't work. And we can talk about our own experiences from hoboing around. And then afterwards, let's look at it on a more business context.
Yeah, because that's the that's what I was especially curious about, whether the concept could at all apply to the business context as well. But let's start with the traveling part. How would you describe your usual ways of traveling? How much planned, scheduled, prepared are you?
I think I'm a kind of hybrid between the two, because I do make plans, I do book things in advance, I do kind of organize accommodation ahead of time, I do book flights quite far in advance, but I can change all of it at any time. I'm not so bound to my schedule.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for instance, this year I've missed 2 flights already.
Intentionally? I mean, you didn't miss them because your taxi was running late or something like that.
No, I had to change my plans, basically.
You let them slip, basically, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I was going to go to Hong Kong before Tokyo, but instead I'm going to Ho Chi Minh now.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of a hybrid between the two. I think I get the benefits of both worlds. I get the, to a certain extent, I think planning certain things ahead of time can also reduce your stress. Because if you know where you're going to stay and you don't have that unknown of, because we're all, you know, these basic human animals that want food and shelter and comfort. And like, it's nice to just kind of know that that's taken care of and you don't have something at the back of your mind. So there is an upside to having things planned in advance. But as I was saying, I get the best of both worlds because I'm able to just, you know, ditch my bookings, ditch my choices of where to stay or whatever. In part, this is because I'm making cheaper arrangements. You know, I'm in Southeast Asia where an apartment costs, you know, anything from $100 a month. You know, big deal if you leave your apartment 2 weeks early. You're only wasting a small amount of money. And likewise with flights. Anyway, it's basically the idea is I'm kind of keeping a hybrid of these two scenarios.
Yeah.
And I do make plans, but they're fairly loose. I do like to kind of make sure I've got accommodation covered. Actually, I'm going to insert a valuable anecdote in here. this is to do with accommodation, because I was going to say it doesn't matter so much in Southeast Asia, but it does if you're going somewhere like Tokyo, where typically monthly rent, you know, at best is going to be $1,000 a month. And so I don't really want to cancel $1,000 unless I really have to. So I often rent apartments from a Japanese company that does serviced apartments, and they're quite good and they're not too expensive, but I have to book everything in advance and pay for everything in advance. And I've never had to try and cancel one of those, and I don't know how easy that would be. However, on my next return to Tokyo, I had arranged to stay at a friend's place who's got a basically a spare flat. And I hadn't paid anything in advance or really nailed down how long I'd be staying at his place either. So when I decided to change my flights, when I needed to change my flights, I was got at no exposure of risk, no exposure of loss to this apartment, because it was an open-ended agreement. There, my friend, is an example of where it does really make sense not to be a tourist when it gets expensive.
The things you mentioned basically have to do with like an upside downside thing. So basically what you talked about is if your commitments are in a reasonable financial range, they are not that binding, right?
Yes.
And yeah, so the, for example, the flights that we had booked from Saigon to Da Nang, which is like a domestic Vietnamese flight, they were only a little less than 30 euros per person. That's not bad. In Europe, you would pay more than that on an average taxi ride, you know, so it doesn't really matter. Okay, so the Flaneur side, before I get to my own preferences, the Flaneur side. We met a friend of ours maybe like 10 days ago in Chiang Mai.
Alexei.
Yeah. He just came in from Pai. And the next day after we met him, Max actually told me that, as usual, Alexei didn't do any kind of advanced bookings. And so he tried to stay at a hotel that he previously stayed in, but they wanted to charge him kind of a premium rate as he was checking in. Well, I don't know. It was definitely after 11 p.m. I don't know how much.
Let me just insert for a moment. We were sat with Alexei in this cafe, and it was like 10 or something. Mm-hmm. And I think he'd been in Chiang Mai for a while, and he was sat opposite the hotel in this cafe.
Yeah.
He could have gone in and checked in
exactly
any time from about 8 p.m., but he was just, no, I'll just do it later.
Yes.
He's like Flaneur of Flaneurs. He
exactly
didn't even want to book the hotel like an hour in advance.
Exactly. That's what's so funny about it. And then it seems like after we had already left and went home, he tried to check in, and they wanted to charge him this premium rate, kind of like double what it said on the website or whatever. So he didn't want to go in, and he was just walking around with Max. I think they even had some late night food, and they were still like, you know, flaneuring around and looking for a place where Alexei could actually stay. And they were coming by this I don't know, Thai kind of, I think it was kind of like a dormitory or whatever. So they went in, and there was the usual night watch guy, you know, sleeping on a couch watching TV, as you have them with all these places. And they were basically like waking the guy up and like, I need a room. And the guy, like Max told me, the guy didn't really even get up. He just like, you know, reached over with his hand, opened a drawer, pulled out a key, gave it to Alexei, and Alexei went upstairs, put his stuff in the room. He obviously then rented a three-bedroom, whatever, dormitory room, which he had for himself. And there was no questions asked or anything. As in sometimes, that's what's so easy about Thailand, you know. Like, next day he paid something like $15 for the night. So you can check in at, I don't know, like 1 o'clock in the morning, 1 a.m. in the morning, and it's still going to work. So you can totally pull the mega flaneur thing.
Indeed.
All right. So my recipe, our recipe for coming to Da Nang was, like Ho Chi Minh was booked because we only stayed for six nights. So we had a friend stay at a place that seemed pretty reasonable, and we just asked him to book us rooms there. And it was absolutely okay and affordable. And in Da Nang, we had booked through Agoda for one night. We came to the hotel, nice hotel, very cheap. And we came to the hotel. We basically decided on the spot we might stay for another night, which they didn't mind. They gave us the same kind of rate. They even upgraded our room to the superior because there's not a lot of people in Da Nang at the moment. So there's lots of empty places to rent. Actually, the next day we went around, looked at a lot of different apartments, houses, and other properties to rent. Then we finally decided to go to this apartment that we have moved in like yesterday. So also a little flaneurish. At around 6 o'clock in the evening, we went back to our hotel. We told them we're gonna check out. We paid 50% of the night, got our stuff in a taxi, and moved into the new apartment because it has, reliable and fast internet and everything. So you can be spontaneous, and we probably spent, I'd say, a couple of hours. Maybe you should think like close to a day, looking at different places, driving around with a little scooter, scouting. And it was kind of fun. It's a little bit like, you know, accommodation shopping, as I call it, as I would call it. But after about like, I don't know, six places, maybe eight places, I don't know, I had enough. And we finally found something that we absolutely liked and booked it.
So let's move on to some more anecdotes from our longer hobo travels. But before we do that, I think we've established one little factoid. Flaneuring works well when, this semi-flaneuring, where we're talking about booking some stuff but subject to cancelling it, that's a good strategy when the costs are low, which I guess is a fairly obvious conclusion. But. So how about the general learnings from 3 years of hoboing? Have either of us, or 4 years, or 7 years, perhaps. In fact, my first trip, the beginnings of hobodom, when I first went to Tokyo, that was actually a flaneur trick, because I'd booked a return flight, and I just decided, because I was only going to Tokyo on holiday, but after 2 weeks, I was like, fuck it, I'm going to stay here. So I just missed my return flight and stayed. But of course, before I did that, well, actually, no, I didn't sell all my stuff. I was having this conversation with someone recently. I still had my studio full of musical gear, computers, you know, everything. But the rent on that studio was pretty low. And actually, I managed to get somebody to sublet it whilst I was away from Japan. And I got one of my friends to sell all my gear as well from whilst I was in Japan. And so basically, it became quite painless in the end. What you'd have thought from the beginning, you'd have thought, that could be potentially tricky because it's a big unknown. What about your stuff? What about the cost of your apartment? Well, maybe it's just my anecdotal experience, but it worked out quite nicely in the end. I had all my stuff sold hassle-free and just had my friend took 10% and transferred the rest into my bank account.
I think we should add, before we get to the learnings of, you know, what you said, like a couple of years of hoboing, we should add to the little factoid that it's not only economics that play a role in this decision making. It's also with traveling with my girlfriend, there's also there's something emotional, like how secure you feel, and there's a certain level of stress that can arise if you don't know where to stay and nothing is really set, and you may need to get some work done, or you got calls scheduled, and that, you know. So the money is and the financials is one part. The other thing is it takes away a lot of uncertainty and maybe possible stress if you settle for stuff.
And I think you've got to know yourself and know when you need that certainty and when it's not so important.
Exactly. And I think even more than that, you don't only need to know yourself, but you need to kind of stretch yourself. Everybody who starts traveling like we do, and you do it without even realizing, you expand what they call your comfort zone. If you have done this a couple of times, you know it's going to work out. And obviously, even somebody like Alexei wouldn't do a thing like that if he wouldn't have already had the experiences from years of traveling in Thailand and so on, that there's always, it's going to be possible. Like, if you can expand this, your range a little bit, this zone, so you don't get stressed just because it's, I don't know, like 2 o'clock in the afternoon and you don't have accommodation for the night. It's also good if you can still be cool about it.
Yeah. So it's like, there's probably an 80-20 here. Things like maybe booking a hotel room for the first night or so when you arrive in a city that you've never been to before.
Exactly. And having something like default options. I think that's, if you know, like, okay, if worst comes to worst, I know somebody who lives in this city, or I could call someone. And if you're traveling in a group, it's a different game than if you're doing it completely by yourself. It's a different thing if you're maybe like a woman than, you know, us. So all things considered, these are basically the moving parts.
Indeed.
We're definitely not tourists. You know, we don't do pre-scheduled trips and you know, bus rides and that kind of stuff. And so we keep our options open and we try to minimize the risks we're having. So it doesn't matter to miss a flight if it's only a couple of bucks or if the hotel night is only like, you know, $15 or $20, which is really a price where you can get a reasonable hotel in Vietnam. So that makes a lot of things way more easy than if, as you said, if you are in Tokyo where everything is really expensive and you don't want to just miss it.
There's a good, great book called The Paradox of Choice.
Exactly.
Which is quite simple concept. You can kind of get the concept just by reading the back. The idea is we've got an abundance of choice in this day and age. We're terrible at making decisions. So a lot can be gained from making decisions where you basically accept the first option that's good enough rather than trying to get the best option.
Yes.
I think this is particularly useful in what we're talking about here, because if you're a flaneur, you might be exposing yourself to the paradox of choice, in that, you know, you want to get the best option. Mm-hmm. Likewise, you might also expose yourself being a tourist, because you might commit to a certain schedule which you can't change and then see something better as you're going on your way. Now, one of the key learnings I got from the paradox of choice is not to worry about the things that you're cutting off by making decisions. You know, like when I came to Chiang Mai, I just rented the place that I'd stayed in before, mm-hmm. and I just rented the first bicycle that I got to.
Exactly.
The place I'm staying is, you know, it's not particularly good value. The bike I was got was pretty shit, and I think I paid too much for it. But actually, both were cheap, both were good enough, mm-hmm. and I haven't, you know, I had my bicycle and my accommodation straight away.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that kind of learning is particularly important in both the flaneur and the tourist sense. The tourist sense, in as much as not regretting the fact that you're not a flaneur, and also the flaneur in not worrying too much about the decisions that you make.
Yeah. And I think apart from the fact that you know, stretch your comfort zone and get cool with things not yet totally set, there's another interesting thing where I find that I learn a lot about myself and the people I'm traveling with, because since we have to make and since we can make these decisions about, you know, what kind of place we want to stay in and so on, time and time again, way more often than somebody who stays in the same place all the time, you get a better feeling for what you need, what your preferences are, and so on and so forth. I'm getting way more attuned to what's really necessary and what I need to feel comfortable, because I have these ongoing tests every couple of weeks or every couple of months.
Indeed.
Now, my question was, if you can be a flaneur, you know, you can go with what feels right, and you don't have to you're not that committed. You can take up seize opportunities and so on and so forth. Do the same mechanics apply in a business concept? How, when, and why, or why not, would it make sense if you run a business to be a flaneur and not a tourist?
This is a good question, sir. A very good question. So straight off the bat, obviously running a business is a different set of conditions than going on holiday. The stakes are much higher, for one, which we can talk about. Also, the first thing that crops into my mind, and perhaps yours too, is the idea of the agile development, which seems to be very much in the flaneur camp.
So, since you're a programmer, Chris, can you explain a little bit how, especially in software development, the problem with how to project manage software development came up? Like, why is that especially something that happens with developing software? And how then does the agile project management approach try to counteract the old problems?
So, there's two main problems that I can think of. One is project size. The bigger software projects get, the more complex they become. They become exponentially more complex. So it's smarter to build something small and incrementally improve it than to just work for ages on something big. The second thing is developers are notoriously bad at understanding end users, which is another reason to do things incrementally, because the developers might have this crazy wacko idea. And if you sit on it and develop a load of things around it for 6 months before you test it in the live environment, then you might waste 6 months of development time. Whereas if you just released it 2 weeks and everybody said this is awful, then you'd only waste 2 weeks.
Yes. And I think software projects in general have this high unforeseeable part in them, because you think you want to build this, but it seems to be really hard. And I'm speaking as a programming layman, obviously, but it's really hard to know at the beginning of a project or even something that you want to build, whatever it is. Like in project management, they are called, in agile project management, they are called the deliverables. So even if you want to create one deliverable, there might be a lot of unforeseeable complications that you only discover along the way. So it's real. You can be really off, it's very probable that you are really, really way off with your estimates before you have started working, right?
Indeed. The idea of running lean, small development cycles, agile development, failing fast, these are all landing more on the flaneur side of the fence.
Yes.
Making decisions on the go rather than making them ahead of time.
To relate it to the analogy of tourist versus flaneur, we could say that in software development, if you're trying to be a tourist, like if you think you can plan ahead a software development project from start to finish, you're never going to be able to stick to your plan. So you cannot be a tourist, because experience has shown in all different teams and companies and so on and so forth, it's just not manageable. It's just not...
Indeed, it's all over the place. I mean, what industry doesn't have projects that go vastly over budget and are super delayed? Just think of that airport in Berlin.
Exactly. We talked about the airport. Yeah. I think they have tripled or quadrupled the estimated budget already, and they are obviously years behind time schedule, so It might be one of the more popular and the more drastic examples, but it's a good bad example.
Yeah. So we've started by basically implying that it's actually very difficult to be a tourist in terms of projects and business. But I'm not sure if the contrary is that easy either.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is what you wanted to talk about, Nico.
Yes, because I think if you're trying to run a business or accomplish something, what I came up with, there might be like two things you need to do. There is time, and there has to be time to be creative and you know, come up with ideas and be very loose about it and relaxed about it. But there's also a part of accomplishing something or running a business where you need to execute. Now, in agile project management, you basically have one day where you kind of go through all the ideas, what in project management would be called like tickets, or in Scrum, for example, which is a specific method of agile project management. It's a good video on YouTube. I'm gonna post it in the show notes, called Scrum in 10 Minutes. So there's a part where you go through all the tickets, all the wish list for your product. And then once you decide on what you're going to be working on for the next, as it's called, a sprint, could be something from 1 week up to, I think the longest might be something like 4 weeks. If it gets longer, it's too much already to be planned properly. And then you have to execute, and you cannot deviate from what you have planned, and you cannot even add something to your list or whatever, because that would, you know, ruin your whole planning.
So it sounds a bit like it's actually a tourist strategy. It's just a very short-term one.
Exactly. So you can be a tourist, but you cannot be a tourist for the whole way of the project. It has to be manageable steps. And compared to the whole project, it might look like baby steps, but these are the ones you can plan.
So it reminds me of being a little bit like us, rather than being like Alexei in the way that we travel. Mm-hmm. Like Alexei was making no plans in advance at all. He will only check into a place where he immediately wants to stay in it. Whereas we would arrange for some accommodation slightly in advance.
Mm-hmm.
So we would make some sort of arrangements in the short term. So it sounds a bit like that. You're making arrangements, but just in the short term. So over the long term, the project acts more like a flaneur is operating it. But just in the short term, if you take up the micro view, it's actually highly touristic and highly organized.
Yeah. And for me, the question even came up, like, how does the tourist flaneur concept apply to business? Is because I feel, especially in business, it matters more if you go astray. Like if you're traveling, here's the distinction I want to make. If you're traveling, it might not necessarily matter where you end up, as long as you enjoy traveling. In business, it matters where you end up.
Unless you enjoy being broke.
And you can afford it. I was just going to say, if you can afford it, yeah. One of the things that also comes back up for me is there might be a possibility to schedule in some flaneur time to your tourist time. Something like what Google has become famous for with, what do they do? Like, do they allow their employees to spend 20 or 10% of their time doing whatever they want?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, and they say that a lot of great, even products that they make a lot of money with now, have come out of this kind of like project time. 37 Signals, now called Basecamp, one of my favorite companies, and we talked, like, I think we mentioned them a couple of times. They have done, I think last year for the first time, and it was so successful, they're going to do it this year again. They have tried and experimented with the whole company taking 1 month off and just doing projects. And anybody in the company can pitch any kind of projects they want to do. I think it doesn't even have to be related to what the company is actually doing. And everybody pitches their project. And if you think that's a nice project and you would want to be on that project, you just go on the team and everybody works on their projects for 1 month company time paid.
Nice.
So it's like an inserted research and development month into the business year. If you run a business and you are totally tied into a schedule, like you're working from the morning till the evening and everything is full, you might not have enough time to think about what you're actually doing. You know, get a little bird's view on where the business is going and maybe readjust it, because you're too deep in doing the work. As it's, you know, like,
and it's just like the under optimizing that I talked about. You need to kind of have a little buffer so you can do that sort of bird's eye view, bigger picture type thinking.
Exactly. If you put 100% of your energy into execution, then you might not see good opportunities and things that come up.
Or I think, succinctly said, you might be executing the wrong thing, but you won't have the time to realize that it's the wrong thing.
Very true. And by the way, since we talked about the under-optimizing concept in the last episode, like confirmation bias, here it comes. Mm-hmm. I have found a couple of examples where that actually applies. And I have even talked to bunch of people about it, and they came up with, like a lot of people have said, some people, I mean, it's not that I met like 120 statistically relevant people over the last couple of days, but you know, some people have said, yeah, that actually makes sense. And it's good to not be fully committed to something, not, you know, not spending all of your energy just in one direction in one thing. So yeah, it got confirmed.
So of course I was right.
Of course. The confirmation bias confirms you were right. Yeah, so do we have a real answer to the tourist flaneur problem in business? Can we sum up a little bit?
I think in the same way that big systems fail because they're too big and small systems are more robust or even anti-fragile, it's like you're creating a series of small systems by having a series of touristic projects that are much smaller rather than having a larger one. Mm-hmm. And also on the flip side, you're not exposing yourself to just being completely flaneur. The flaneuring is in the fact that you do flaneuring over the long term, but on the short term, you're keeping things highly organized. Mm-hmm. So you're executing. Mm-hmm. I think that's one little factoid we've drawn up.
Exactly.
But looking at this kind of logically, I'm wondering if there are some things which over the long term are better not flaneured. Like a trivial example is you've got to do your corporate accounts every year. Otherwise you get like fines from the tax authorities or get investigated or whatever. So I wonder what might not benefit from flaneuring over the long term. What might lend itself to better be organized in a touristic way.
Yeah, I know what you're pointing at. I think we have mentioned it and we will probably come back to it soon. The whole concept of getting things that are really repeatable and that are going to come up and that are not even that enjoyable, like especially accounting and taxes and stuff, it's very good if you get it done, and if you can prepare it and pre-schedule it and have a, you know, like a defined process for it so that it doesn't accumulate into a lot of stress.
Mm.
If it's really something that follows very simple rules, like, you know, the whole problem with software development, as we stated earlier, is it is complicated and it has these unforeseeable complications that you didn't think about or that you couldn't even think about at the beginning of the project. So that's one thing. But accounting, I don't think the complexities or the possible complications are that high. It should be more manageable.
Also, there might be... So software development is perhaps a creative process, but then you've got things like shipping, logistics, customer support. There's bound to be plenty of areas in business which don't respond well to flaneuring. Like, you know, if your support staff kept hours, they just worked when they felt like it and went on holiday when they felt like it or had a month off, that wouldn't do very well for customer support, obviously.
Yes.
And same way for the postal service.
Exactly. I was just thinking about Amazon and how they run, you know, how efficiently they run their operations. I'm getting more and more amazed by the way that they're not coming to Southeast Asia. That's really it's a shame. But you remember, I don't know what the English terms are, but the flaneur versus tourist thing. Do you remember the different ways how you can organize a storehouse? Is it a storehouse? A warehouse?
Warehouse.
Yeah, so whereas the old way was one item has one specific location, and then later with the help of computers and so on, they came up with this dynamic kind of system where the people or the robots or whatever that go through the warehouse can kind of flaneur around because they can just say, oh, look, there's space here. We can just store stuff here as long as we put it in the database and then later on it can be found again.
Mm.
Earlier, that kind of complexity couldn't be handled, but then with technology, at some point it could.
Which is, I guess, very similar to how hard disks work.
Exactly.
You create a folder system on your hard drive where you access files and stuff that doesn't in any way correspond to where the data actually is on the hard drive. It's just, you know, distributed all over the place.
Mm-hmm. But before the digital era, the kind of complexity couldn't be handled that easy.
So it's a bit like you've got different layers that are sort of operating independently of each other. And you've got tourist layers and flaneur layers and tourist layers and flaneur layers. Because it's like the robots filing stuff in the Amazon warehouse. It's fine for them to flaneur around because we've got that ability to handle that complexity. So in a sense, it doesn't appear like they're flaneuring around anymore. It sort of acts as though it's a tourist thing where it's kind of well-defined and predictable.
Mm-hmm.
And then like on top of that, you can build your touristy-like functions like know that you can deliver something within a certain period of time. And it reminds me again a bit of the agile development process where you're kind of breaking up the project into small discrete blocks and being very touristic about how you execute those blocks. So it's like you've kind of got this flaneur big picture, but this touristic blocks, which it's made up of. And mm-hmm. So it's like we're looking at interleaved layers. You've got one touristic layer sitting beneath a flaneur layer, which is, I don't know, maybe sitting beneath another tourist layer. I don't know if I'm getting a bit abstract, but...
I know what you're saying. Yeah, and I'm just also wondering if... I'm wondering if something like this will be possible for scheduling meetings and calls and stuff in the future as well, where you basically, you know, you don't have to worry about like sending everybody an invitation and then... You know, it's Ooh. Still a fairly complex thing with the shared calendars and stuff and Doodle.
This is a good topic.
If there would be a software, yeah.
Let's flaneur into this topic. Let's talk about scheduling and meetings and stuff like that.
I'd be interested if there could be a software that I just say, I want to have a scheduled call with Chris and this other person and this other person. And then the software would just like find the best suitable kind of overlap without even us having... to do too much interaction and so on. That would be like awesome.
Yeah, maybe the software knew how we generally liked to do things and behave and could make reasonable suggestions. Or better still, just this would be good. Because what I like doing is being quite spontaneous with my meetings and particularly social.
Yeah.
I don't like to plan in advance. I just think, I'd like to see someone now. And I phone them and I tend to make friends with people who I can reliably flaneur with.
Yeah, I was just going to say, yeah.
It doesn't always work. Some people don't respond well. But anyway, the idea is like, if I think, I'd like to do something and then have access to being able to do that, like the software could maybe make kind of guesses as to where and when that might work. So it's like you could kind of press the meeting button and then it will just sort of go out and find some people who are ready for a meeting. I don't know. Let's still look at scheduling. Having lived in Tokyo a long time, where pretty much nobody, apart from a few of my friends, are spontaneous. I mean, it's understandable because everybody in Tokyo works just ridiculously long hours, has very little holiday, typically lives a half an hour to an hour train journey from the center. So kind of coordinating a meeting is quite a big deal because there's a small window of opportunity plus like a high cost to getting there. I solved this by moving to the center, which automatically put me where everybody meets up anyway. Fortunately, a lot of other people that I know have realized the same thing and all live in the center. It's kind of self-selecting, really. If you're one of those sort of spontaneous people, then you're going to really suffer if you don't live somewhere where you've got immediate access to socializing. So, yeah, that's one thing I wanted to say. The other thing is, basically, in Tokyo, they say if you want to meet someone, you've got to give 2 weeks' notice at least. It's true. I mean, I'd get people giving me like 2 months' notice. It's not unusual. Really. So 2 weeks is like the kind of, I mean, basically, if I'd kind of try and organize something for the coming weekend, it would be really hard. You know, so many people wouldn't be able to come because they had something else booked. However, here's a little secret. What I found was people would struggle with responding to something within that 2 week period. If it was beyond 2 weeks, then you might get a good response. But if it's within 2 weeks, you'd seldom get anybody responding. But what I found is if you gave them almost no notice, then that actually worked quite well. Because basically, if you call someone at 5 p.m. about going out that evening, in Tokyo standards, there's no way they'll have anything booked. Or they'll be on it already, kind of thing. They'll either be on their way to something or they'll have a free evening. So it's like it's like the lastminute.com idea.
Anyway,
that was my little hack.
I'm interested into how that's gonna turn out. I think there's some apps, especially on mobile phones, that kind of also let you connect to people in the same area and you can put activities in and you could basically say, I'd like to play some basketball and I could be at the court in 15 minutes and then other people, you know, with the same kind of interest could get a kind of notification and the app could kind of create this meeting on the spot and either check if there's already somebody there and you can join or if there's enough people in the area that might be interested and so on.
So perhaps we've flaneured a bit too far away from flaneuring in tourism.
Yeah, flaneuring is nice, you know. It's it feels way easier. I think that's why it's so way more appealing. It doesn't feel and sound as bureaucratic and as planned. But as I'm saying, I still see this challenge that most people will tend to not plan ahead, and especially also with a lot of the biases that we mention. And our inability to see and look into the future, like, you know, like saving up money and so on and so forth. Flaneuring is nice, but there's definitely a place for things that are pre-scheduled and really neatly planned. I think most people have a harder time getting used to the touristic approach than being a flaneur. Flaneuring is probably easier.
So I think we've reached a good point in which to wrap this episode up.
I think so too.
Yes. So be touristic in your flaneuring and flaneuring in your tourism.
Exactly. And get comfortable with both approaches and find out be flexible and find a good a good mix that suits your economic restrictions, your emotional limitations, and then you will learn. I think it's my experience. I'm learning a lot about myself and how I can handle both sides of the game.
Marvelous. So, Mr. Apple.
Yes.
Thank you for joining, and thank you, Hobos, for listening in.
Yeah, thanks very much.
See you guys. See you again next time.
See you soon.
All right. I'm a hobo.
Hacks, hiring, hovering, lunching, launching, morality, morons, pipe dreams, protons, hunting, leaping, jumping, kite surfing, landing pages, optimization, and superheroes.
It's a kind of magic.
Another amazing podcast magic production.